The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Conspiranormal.
All right, welcome to Conspiranormal, everybody. We are, I guess, now really officially back from our long sojourn from the Strange Realities Conference and everything that that entailed, and happy to be back. We got Professor Wham with us tonight. We're going to do kind of like, I guess, a little shorter interview than usual, but this is going to be like kind of a follow-up to, when did we do that, Professor Wham? I think it was back in April, I think we did that
show.
Yeah,
it was back in April. I re-listened to it.
Yeah, and I got a really good response off of it, actually. I actually had somebody comment on it on the YouTube version just a few days ago, actually about 6 months later. So just kind of goes to show that people are really interested in these topics. And what we're going to talk about is kind of an update on the show that we did about Robert Berdella and how you knew him and all that. So let's talk about, I guess, give a little kind of recap of what we talked about, so if people missed that. And we'll just go from there.
Robert Berdella was a serial killer who was active, I guess, is the actual word that is used, who was active in Kansas City in the mid-1980s for probably about 4 or 5 years, I think, where he was active. The reason that I talked about him was because I had known him for the better part of a decade. I had worked in his shop. And so basically I just talked about my memories about him, my thoughts about him, some of the investigations I'd done into you know, his possible connections to other things, to, for example, certain drug or sex syndicates that were connected to the Franklin conspiracy. Franklin scandal. I know we talked about that. But it was mostly sort of me talking about my experiences and my memories. Mm-hmm. And because I hadn't ever publicly talked about this stuff before. And I remember that I had approached you with it back in February because mm-hmm. for some reason, something inside told me, this sounds so weird, but something inside told me to ask you if you guys would be interested in this. And the thing that is interesting about it is that as a result of the recording that we did, I was contacted by an individual who has to remain anonymous, but I do have their identity. And they are a younger relative of one of the victims. And because this happened in their family, they became sort of obsessed with trying to figure out what had happened. You know, because they had memories, they were very young when it happened. And so they had some memories of their relative who died, who was a victim. But it just obviously it affected the family profoundly. And so this person has dedicated a big chunk of their life to figuring out the ins and outs of it. And some of what they shared with me is some of the information that I'll give tonight, because they have done a lot more sort of interior research than I have. I mean, they live in Kansas City, so they have access to things that I do not. And they've spent a great deal of time archiving material, such as they've been able to find it. And they have connections with and have made friends with some of the detectives, or one of the detectives in particular, who was involved with the initial investigation. So there's some interesting stuff that came out of it. And this individual helped me track down some memories that I'd had about, just some vague memories I'd had about in from the early 80s, even before I knew Bob, about this place that I'd mentioned where I knew that people that kids were being trafficked. And they actually helped me hunt that place down. The place with the fountain and everything, and did confirm for me that this was a place where this stuff happened, because given the research they were able to show me.
And I think you also tied that a little bit into the Franklin cover up too, which was about the same time that this was going on.
Right. It was about the same time that this was going on. And this individual had also made some of those connections as well. And in fact, is in contact with Nick Bryant. Nick Bryant is still investigating this stuff, sort of underneath and behind the scenes and stuff. And he has got several investigators that sort of do this on their own, that feed him information as they find it. Mm-hmm. And one of them is in Omaha, and it's a woman. This contact that I have actually knows this woman, and has had a number of exchanges with her about the possibility of Bob's connection in various ways to various elements of the Franklin scandal. Okay. So in other words, some of those intuitive connections mm-hmm. that I had made, this person has confirmed that there are things about that that are real. And that these investigations are still ongoing, by the way, so that they haven't ended, not even after 35 years or however long it's been.
Mm-hmm. There's really something about that when your gut feeling gets validated by information you later find in other people.
Well, and what was interesting is that this person contacted me and they said that, you know, we exchanged a few things back and forth. And this person was also trying to clarify a few things because and they reminded me they'd collected all of the newspaper clippings from the time period and from the Kansas City papers and were showing them to me, you know, having these email exchanges. I think we exchanged like almost 50 emails back and forth. And this person was asking me particular questions about to clarify certain things to figure, mm-hmm. she's trying to figure out who I was. You know, did you know this person? Did you know this person? Did you know that this was going on? You know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, it was an interesting exchange. But one of the things they said was that, you know, they were surprised that I had made correct intuitive leaps with a lot less information than they had. And I said, well, the truth is that a lot of this stuff sort of operates the same way. You know, you've seen one syndicate, you've seen them all. You know what I mean? And in a place like the Midwest, you know, the bad apples in Omaha are going to know who the bad apples in Kansas City are. And I just know that because of the drug trades in those two cities. Right. So, you know, just...
Yeah, once you develop those street smarts, for lack of a better word, you know, a lot of times your spidey sense can really get attuned to those mm-hmm. type of things.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it was interesting. I mean, some things that I talked about were validated and some things were changed. So I think that you'll be interested in knowing about this. The first thing that I wanted to say, though, is that I remember one of the things that I said in the first interview was that one of the ways in which Berdella's victims were different is that they tended to be older. And this is actually still true, is that if you look at the majority of men, like Jeffrey Dahmer, for example, or John Wayne Gacy, who are gay men who prey on other males. They tend to prey on males that are much younger than they are, or in much more vulnerable circumstances. And so it is interesting that Bob did prey on people that were fully adult. My estimate of their age was a little old. Okay. So it turned out they were a little younger than I thought. What I said was that they were tending towards their 30s. There was only one victim that was close to his 30s. So what I wanted to do, though, is correct what I consider to be a negligent error on my part and not actually name the victims, because that to me is really important. Because, of course, obviously they are the important people in these narratives. So, and these are the victims that we know of, six victims that we know of. Bob, when he was arrested, he was under suspicion for the disappearance of some other people, but it's never been demonstrated that he, in fact, was associated with their deaths. But anyway, the first victim was Jerry Howell. He was 19. The second victim was Robert Sheldon. He was 20. The third victim was Mark Wallace, and he was the oldest at 27. The fourth victim was James Ferris, and he was 25. The fifth victim was Todd Stoop, and he was 23. And then the last victim, known victim, was Larry Wayne Pearson. He was 20. And this was an individual that Bob actually met at his shop. So it's the only person that I am aware of that he actually met at his shop. And this individual became a victim.
And all the rest, maybe he would pick up somewhere, or were they like,
they would come to him in various ways. Yeah. Sometimes they started out as he would go down to the bus stop and he would hang out. A lot of them were hustlers. You know, they hustled on the side, either to make money or because they had drug habits or something, you know what I mean? So he met a lot of them that way. And then he would sort of do this thing where he would take them under his wing and he was going to, you know, get them jobs and help them kind of redo their lives. And what's interesting is that in several, each one of these cases is a little bit different. You know, the first two, victims died largely because of the wounds that they suffered. In other words, you know, he didn't actually murder them directly. They died as a result of what he was doing to them, and torturing them. The third victim is, I believe, if I remember correctly, he was the first one that was actively killed. And I believe he was killed because there was like a workman coming to the house to do some construction on the house, and Bob didn't want him to be found, and so he killed him to get rid of him. And as he accumulated more victims, the tortures became worse, and he became more and more sort of obsessive about it. One of the things that I did not know, and that, so therefore I got wrong, essentially, is that apparently, and this is according to one of the things that this individual did and shared with me, is because of this individual's obsession with this, this individual has gone into criminal investigation, all right? And so, at one point, one of the head detectives, I guess he was the head detective, Detective Hearn, I can say that because that's a matter of record. And he's retired now. He came to this person's class to specifically give a talk about Berdella and to be asked questions about it. This person and surreptitiously taped this. Wasn't supposed to do this, but surreptitiously taped it and has archived it and in a couple of different places, but online, has archived it online, kind of in a secret, you know, how you can put stuff up on YouTube but not list it, you know, it could sort of be private. And they shared the link with me. So I was actually able to listen to this secretly recorded talk that this detective gave about Berdella. And one of the things that I did not know that came to light in their investigation, and it was never made public, was that he in fact had a very, very terrible relationship with his mother. It was never made clear in the lecture exactly what that relationship, what made it terrible, but apparently he felt trapped by her in some way, trapped by her Catholicism in some way. And they found evidence in the house of a kind of weird psychological ritual that he had done. And this was before apparently he had killed anyone, and it's, you know, they described how he had outfitted part of his house with gates, and it was part of a ritual in order to free himself psychologically from the control that he believed his mother had over him. So he had developed this kind of obsession with creating a kind of spiritual power for himself. You know, one of the things I got wrong was, you asked me specifically if he was involved in any kind of spirituality or spiritual practice. I didn't know of any because of what he told me, but apparently he was. It was sort of his own creation. It was kind of a hodgepodge of a number of different things, but the whole purpose behind it was to create enough power behind him so that he could get away with doing what he was doing, which was being a sexual sadist, essentially. And so he did have an upper room that was, the house had like three stories and a basement, a full basement. And so he did have like this kind of secret upper room, which he referred to in his, according to the detective in his interviews with them, he referred to as his introspection room. And in this introspection room, he had all kinds of power objects that he had collected in his antiquities trade. When they uncovered it and took the house apart, they took the house apart meticulously, like brick by brick, because they were trying to see if there were any victims, like or other evidence, like walled up in various places. And they actually did find some pieces of victims, like in these secret cubby holes and stuff. Wow. But in this introspection room, when they opened it up and went in, he apparently did have like a copy of, I guess it was a recording, it was like an LP of Anton LaVey's Black Mass.
I've got a reissue of that.
Oh, really?
So apparently he was into something. And if you remember, I told the story about how I'd had this really bizarre experience when I did this initial meditation to try to figure out like what was going on with him. And I encountered this really dark force that just sort of seemed to invade the room. And so that kind of makes sense of that to me. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, okay. So he was in fact screwed up, you know, in that particular way. And in order to do this, in order to generate the power, the energy for this, the tortures just got worse and worse and worse for these poor guys, you know. And again, I don't want to go into everything that he did. He kept meticulous records of everything. I mean, if people have that kind of prurient interest, which they do, obviously, they can look up the book, that the one true crime book that was written about him. Which brings me to one of the other things that this contact told me was apparently the evidence locker, all of the evidence that they collected for Berdella, there is a lot of evidence that evidence, you know, his diaries and the ropes that he used to bind his victims and, you know, all that kind of stuff, like the shirts that his victims were wearing when they died, you know, and things like that. Those were all pieces of evidence, and that, and his evidence has been very improperly handled. And somehow, for some reason, it has gotten out onto the black market. And there's this huge market in selling items that are connected to his crimes, you know, like, you know, so many, you know, so many bitcoins for, you know, for the ropes that tied up Rob, you know, Sheldon, you know, I mean, it's just, it's grotesque.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really morbid.
And in fact, there have been a number of, there is at least one or two civil lawsuits that are pending that have been ongoing against I think it's the prosecuting attorney that for some reason released all this stuff to various people. And there are lawsuits about trying to, against him and against some of the companies, some of the sort of shadow companies mm-hmm. that are selling this stuff by some of the families of the victims, you know, because it's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, and if he believed that objects contained dark spiritual power, that's kind of wild that his objects would then go off into some kind of illicit trade, perhaps being purchased by people who believed in the same kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's kind of, you know, or people who, yeah, I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. I mean, I'm not entirely sure why you would want a bloody t-shirt from a murder victim.
There's such a morbid fascination.
Yeah.
With serial killer
wear that? I mean, oh my God.
Yeah. How would they have gotten that? Because wouldn't that stuff be like put into evidence?
Well, that's what I mean. That his evidence locker has been raided, essentially. And according to both the detective and to the source, this stuff was released at some point to the prosecuting attorney, and the prosecuting attorney then released it to various individuals who claimed that they were members of Bob's family, but were not. Because Bob's family wasn't very big, you know? And so they were just saying, they were just taking this stuff so that they could resell it.
What other kind of objects were in that introspection room?
Based on, I mean, the detective didn't go into great detail about it. He said that there were various of Berdella's favorite artifacts from different places. I mean, what I can tell you is that Berdella had excellent, well, you know, I mentioned he had like, at the time when they assessed his collection, it was like the fifth largest collection of antiquities that had been assembled in North America at that time.
Wow.
So he had excellent connections throughout Indonesia and other parts of Asia and Africa and South America. And I know from my own working with the material at his shop, that a lot of the stuff that he had to have come through the black market. Mm-hmm. It had to have been stolen, right. You know, cultural artifacts and stuff. I'll never forget, there was this magnificent Kalachakra statue that he had there that was still, you know, I don't know how much you know about these objects, but when they're consecrated, they are fitted. There's a sacred scroll that is inserted in the base.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes another one that's inserted, like maybe at the area of the crown chakra and wherever, you know, whatever whoever the deity on top is. And then it's sealed. And that's what's consecrates that object, essentially. You know, it's sort of understood to be sort of a living being in a way. Well, he had objects that had never been unconsecrated. You're supposed to remove that stuff.
Wow.
So it's like that stuff would be still spiritually active in a lot of ways. In fact, I have in my possession a human bone mala that I saved from his store because I recognized it. And those are very unique items. Those are items that are specific to an individual or to a particular, say, lineage, because they are made of, the beads are made, are punched from the skulls of monks who have been in a lineage, and you know, their bodies have probably been committed to a sky burial. And then they'll take the skulls and they'll make beads with them. And then it, you know, and you have 108 beads in a mala. So that, it, you know, it may be six or seven people's skulls that are used to create one of these malas. And so if there's a whole one, I mean, this is something that's given from, like, you know, a teacher to a disciple. It isn't something that you would sell. You would never sell that. But he somehow got a hold of one.
Yeah.
And had it for sale. And I saw it. I just got it. It was like, because I knew it was like this. First of all, you're not supposed to sell human bone like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually illegal to do. I mean, he had the papers of provenance and stuff, but it's, you're still not supposed to do it. And so I just took it. I still have it. I haven't figured out exactly what to do with it. I restrung it because it needed to be restrung so that the beads could be preserved. But I'm thinking about taking it to a Tibetan center up here, not too far from where I live, and explaining. I don't know if I'll explain exactly where it came from.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, but,
yeah, it's good that it got in the hands of someone who has respect, you know, at least then.
It wasn't just picked up to be, you know, worn. Because most people that would buy it, they just wear it as a necklace. It's like, this is not a necklace. It's a holy object, you know. But anyway, so I would imagine that he had things like that, you know, probably his favorite things like that up there in his room. And he did collect objects that were known to have like dark powers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't sell many of those in the shop, but I did know that, I was at his house a couple times in the lower floors. So I know that he had some of this stuff. Let's see here. Okay. I talked about that. Oh, the other thing is that apparently, and this was difficult to understand exactly in the tape, but the detective talked about when they went down into the basement, which is where the dismembering of the bodies occurred. It was right below where the torture room was. There was like Berdella's bedroom, like, and that on the first floor, I think it's, yeah. And then there was like a room that was adjacent to that was sort of the torture room where that stuff happened. And then right below it was a place in the basement where he, you know, dismembered the body so that he could put them in garbage sacks and send them out to the landfill. But apparently there was this big timber, you know, it was a beam that held up, you know, a principal beam that held up the part of the house at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was right underneath that torture chamber. Well, apparently he had painted some kind of signs or sigils right there. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that the detective didn't know exactly what they were because he couldn't name them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I don't know what they were, but he did indicate there were signs of some type.
Are there any pictures that were taken by the police or anything?
There might have been, but I don't know where they are. You know, and given the scattering of the evidence, who the hell knows?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see that because maybe, I mean, I'm sure that some people amongst our crowd could probably find out what those probably know what those are.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I probably recognize them if I saw them, if I knew what they were. But right. You know, there's no way for me to know that.
Had you known him to draw anything like that when you knew him?
No, this was not something I knew about him. In fact, I didn't think. I mean, I knew that he probably knew some things because he read that kind of stuff. You know,
right?
But you know, I did not know that he practiced anything because you know, he even denied stuff like that. He could poo-poo it, you know, in public.
Do you think the reason that stuff got raided and why it's lost is because he went to prison and he's dead now and nobody really like justice was served, so nobody really
cares
as much.
During the interview, somebody just point blank asked the detective, why is it that hardly anybody knows about Berdella when everybody knows about Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy and,
right.
you know, a bunch of other, yeah. you know, killers? Why is it that Berdella's case just got buried? And what's interesting is that the detective kind of hedges a little bit at this. And then in a very low voice, which you have to listen to very closely, he basically said that it had to do with political realities that were going on in Kansas City at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he would say about it. And it was like, okay, then, you know, what does that mean? It's like, I mean, political realities don't keep things out of the papers, not usually. So there had to be something else going on there. I don't know, though. I mean, it's, you know, it just opens the door of speculation immediately. Now, what is interesting is that according to the detective, when he was interviewed, Bob made mention several times of that he was a member of a special group, a special unique group. That if he, and that was the reason why he had kept such meticulous torture and murder logs, because those logs, if he ever got arrested, those logs would provide information for members of this group that would be interested in murder. Now, I have no idea if Berdella was BSing the detectives or not. There was some evidence occasionally that he did, you know, just sort of flipping his, you know, you want to hear this anyway. The detective, there were rumors that he was connected to people. The detective said that there wasn't, he disputed the idea that there was any physical evidence that anybody else was involved in the actual torture and killing of these men. I have heard from other sources differently. So I think that it's an open question at the moment. You know, I do think that the later victims in particular, probably Berdella did himself because he became more and more selfish and insular about this process. But I think in the beginning, it is possible that there may have been some other people involved. And that's just what I've heard from other sources that are as good as this detective. So, you know, whatever, you know, I don't know what that means though.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Well, in that, the illicit antiquities trade, you know, goes up to pretty wealthy and powerful people. So something like that could really put him, you know, close to some circles of people who were searching for, you know, ancient objects with power.
Oh, yeah. Well, and apparently I did find out something about a little bit about where he got at least some of his drugs. Some of the drugs that he used to subdue these guys. He used ACE, he used ketamine, and he used a number of other chemicals. And some of these drugs he got from a vet in the West Bottoms because he had chow dogs. And he traded some of these antiquities for these drugs. And then he would use some of those drugs on the victims, on the guys. Now, I also heard from a very good source that he also got other pharmaceuticals such as Thorazine, which you cannot get under those conditions, and you could only get through some kind of an illicit trade. Ketamine was probably the easiest, cheapest thing to get, especially if you're getting it for a discount because you've handed the vet a bunch of antiquities. You know what I mean? So, you know, but anyway, they know that he got at least some of his drugs from this vet. The vet's name has never, the individual is not in Kansas City anymore and was not charged with anything. So my contact did not know what that person's name was. One of the things that was interesting about the detective is that he went into some detail about how they were going to try to psych Bob out. They figured out, you know, Bob knew the police. He'd had a long relationship with them, you know, not a good one, but a long relationship with them off and on, didn't like them at all. And so when they came across, you know, all the evidence that they found, they called Quantico, you know, called the FBI to get some advice to see whether he or not they could kind of psych him into confessing or giving more information or, you know, whatever they were going to do. And this was right after, you know, not long after they'd arrested him, maybe 3 or 4 days after they'd arrested him, and had started going through the house, you know, digging up the backyard and finding the evidence of, you know, multiple victims and that kind of thing. And so the detective was, he was very gleeful in talking about how Berdella apparently considered him, Detective Hearn, to be sort of his arch enemy. And so one of the things that, you know, that Quantico advised them to do was to do various things to sort of build him up, you know, to make him think that that the people in the Kansas City Police Department regarded him as an important person. And then at some point, I can't recall now, I think it was in an interview that Berdella had made the comment that he felt that he had amassed enough black power or enough dark power that the only thing that he feared was, as he put it, according to the detective, this is what Berdella said. I don't know if Berdella actually said this or not, or whether this was the detective reading into what he said, but that Berdella said that the only thing he feared was a powerful white Wiccan priest. And of course, in my mind, I'm going, white Wiccan. Wiccans are only white magic anyway, so that's confusing to me. But are we talking, is this an ethnic identification? I don't know. But anyway, this is the way I'm thinking when I'm listening to this guy. But anyway, so they did this whole thing where according to the detective, they contacted a high priest and high priestess of, as he put it, a very important coven in the Kansas City area. I mean, I was very familiar with the covens in the Kansas City at the time. And I'm like, I'm racking my brain, like, what important coven are we talking about here? You know,
who is this?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of this. And apparently, according to this detective, what they did was they asked this powerful priestess or, you know, this couple to cast a ring that they would use sort of surreptitiously and pull out at a certain moment in the interview in order to psych Bob out. Well, here's the deal. After I racked my brain over that, I realized that I think I knew who these people were. And I think that because there was only one couple in the Kansas City area at the time that were touting themselves as having that kind of authority and power, but also were jewelers and had the ability to just instantly cast something like that. And it probably wasn't a ring that was actually made for the occasion. That would take too long. Right. It was just probably one of their inventory rings, you know, yeah, maybe they added something to it or whatever. The reason why, because what happened was their ruse failed. And Detective Hearn talks about this in order to talk about how cagey Berdella was. You know, they tried to build Berdella up and up, and then at this one crucial moment, you know, he reaches into his pocket and he puts this, you know, ring on, like he's the Wiccan priestess, right, or priest, and then like pulls it out and lets Bob see it, and as soon as Bob sees it, apparently, he said his whole affect went flat. He quit talking and he said the words that every detective dreads to hear. I want to see my lawyer.
Oh man.
and when I heard that, I thought to myself, you know why he did that? It wasn't because it was a ring of a white Wiccan priest. It was because he recognized the style of the ring. He knew who made it because he was business associates with them too.
Mm.
Okay. And so he knew who made it. So he was like, screw this, I'm not going to talk.
Yeah, he called, he called the ruse. It seems like he had a little bit of
that. He wasn't an idiot, you know.
Yeah, it seems like he had a little bit of, he had a little bit of magical thinking, and they played on that. And then the second thing is that you talk about how they were building him up. That was a very similar way that how actually the police caught BTK. I mean, they, right. You know, they, a lot of these guys are narcissists.
Oh yeah.
And they really just, they have this inflated sense of self-importance, and police can really play on that to make them basically, you know, mess up. But it sounds like he kind of called their bluff on that.
He did. He called the bluff. And I mean, and I'm not saying he wasn't a narcissist. He was, absolutely. And right. And a sexual sadist of the worst variety. But no, he called him on it. And what was interesting was that let's see here. One of the things that came up after that in the interview was that one of the questions was what was Buck Berdella's diagnosis? You know, because they did have psychologists come in and try to diagnose him and talk to him and stuff like this. And what is interesting is that several psychologists who do this regularly with these kinds of guys said that of all the people that they talked to, he was one that they could not diagnose. His pathology could not be classified. In fact, the clinician who diagnosed John Wayne Gacy and examined Berdella said that Berdella was so unique in his pathology that he didn't think he could adequately describe or diagnose his condition. So, yeah, I mean, it's like, wow.
That kind of lends to some of the ideas you talk about, too, where there's a... where you think there may be a spiritual dimension to this. So there's something that can't be easily diagnosed by psychiatrists and psychologists because it's something else entirely.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, when I think back to the experience that I had and what I encountered, I've never encountered anything before or since, and I hope never to again. It was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. And I'm just really grateful that I was able to shut it down. I mean, it was almost Lovecraftian, seriously, in terms of the kind of energy and darkness that it had. It was like, it was completely alien to anything that I was familiar with. And it was, it was a complete and utter aware predator. That's about the only way I can describe it. And the worst part about it was that, as I mentioned in the first interview, you know, this is reflected somewhat in the story that I wrote, you know, about some of these elements of it. I lived for many years with this fear that it had seen me, you know, like I had seen it and it saw me and it saw that I saw it, you know, and so did that mean that it could come and get me? Now, I don't think it can, actually, because I do think that there are kind of spiritual rules in the universe that sort of prevent that sort of thing. But, you know, just the thought of that for years haunted me, you know, because it was like, I was just, it just added this extra sense of paranoia to everything, you know?
Yeah. I could see how that would happen.
Right. I mean, you wrote that short story about that. Yeah. The very concept.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that short story, I wrote it not in order for it to make sense, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. But I mean, in a normal, rational way, but in order to express some of the emotional impact of it, you know, the kind of just the kind of things that it brings up emotionally and viscerally in me when I've thought about it in the past. So it was just sort of, you know, sort of a catharsis and just sort of barfing it out. It's a form, you know, on the written page, you know. I don't even know that it's a good story. I have no idea. It's like, you know, nothing that I'm talking about tonight is a good story. This is not a good story.
But yeah, that could be helpful to just process it in that way, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically this individual is still doing their research, and you know, there are still some loose ends, you know, things that they are hunting down to try to figure out. You know, there's always loose ends and stuff like this. Because there are a lot of unanswered questions about, you know, what Bob's larger connections were. And I don't know that we'll ever know exactly the answer to those questions. But I wanted to kind of share this update of information with you guys, because I think it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. That was fascinating. And just that idea that, like, some of these, you know, instincts you had, and also because of, like you said, some street smarts, but to have that stuff corroborated and backed up by other people's research, that's got to be really, really cool.
Well, and also, you know, I mean, I know that some people don't like this. I don't mind it so much as a historian, as someone who's a historian. I don't mind if I'm corrected. Mm-hmm. You know, if I find out that my memory is faulty, or because all of our memories are faulty. Yeah. You know, when I think of the Berdella in my life, I honestly think of Berdella in a very emotional way. You know, because these were events that I was attached to, that, you know, I mean, I'm not a victim like his victims were, but, you know, all of us that were associated with him were affected by and tainted in certain ways by that action, by those things that he did. And I talked to the contact about that, because, you know, this individual has become so embroiled in this information, gathering this information. And some of the information, of course, is involved with conspiracy. No, not like high level conspiracy theories, but the conspiracies that are kept and maintained by a corrupt police department.
Yeah.
You know, the conspiracies that are attendant to, you know, drug and sex trafficking of people, and that still go on. You know, and when you do that kind of work, you tend to see things in a possibly conspiratorial light. You know, you see the external part of something, but you also know that there's always a deeper, more internal part of it. And so part of my conversation with this person was convincing them, you know, clarifying some things for them, but also convincing them that I was not part of this conspiracy.
Mm, yeah. Yeah.
You know, because I'm not. And
it's easy to get things convoluted. Once you make connections between people, a lot of assumptions happen when people are into that conspiratorial thinking.
Right. And you know, this person doesn't know me. All they know is that all of a sudden they found out that there's this individual who knew Berdella and is talking on a podcast about it, you know? And so they finally were able to locate my name in a couple of the newspaper articles that were published at the time. And I was able to say, yeah, that was me. That was me. No, no, I was not this person. I was this person, that sort of thing. But, you know, so, you know, we corrected each other's information, you know, checked each other on that. But I, you know, to me, I don't mind being wrong as long as the information that is brought in in such a way that it helps me to understand sort of the larger picture that even I'm a part of, you know what I mean? It's fine.
Yeah. For anyone who wants to learn and grow, I mean, that's going to be a part of it.
Right.
Found you through this podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
I guess that maybe there's not a lot of material that's on him.
I mean, that is interesting, you know, I mean, that's part of it, you know, why that individual asked that question of that detective. You know, if you go back and you look at other serial killers, you know, they have documentaries and you know, multiple books and all kinds of stuff, but Berdella just doesn't. I mean, the only people that have less are people that we know less about, you know, like people like Isaac Keys and stuff like that, you know, where because he took most of the information about most of his murders to his grave. You know, we don't really know that much about what he did because that was sort of his power secret, you know, keeping everything, you know, hidden like that, you know, spitefully, essentially, from authorities or from the victims' families. But anyway, so that's all of the updates that I have for you on that.
Yeah, I'm very curious too about the link to the Franklin scandal and all that.
Yeah.
That's another aspect of this that is really kind of piqued my interest when you first talked about it. And it's interesting too that this person was able to provide you with a little bit more of a clarity on that, and that there might have been some things going on.
Right. Well, and they confirmed that there are suspicions among Franklin scandal investigators about things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, me. And what was weird to me is that what clicked in my head, and I can't even remember now what it was, but what clicked in my head was I was reading Nick Bryant's book, and Nick Bryant mentions, just like in a couple of paragraphs in like the middle of the book, just sort of as an aside, he mentions some things about Kansas City and some other stuff. And all of a sudden something just went boom. And it was like, oh, I do that a lot though, where I make these sort of meta connections that are usually right. I mean, they may need to be filled out a little bit in terms of detail, but they are usually, you know, kind of broadly correct in terms of, and it's not conspiratorial thinking, it's seeing patterns. It's part of, I guess, what made me a good book buyer when I was I've always been in retail. I've always been a really good buyer, whether it was books or when I purchased for Whole Foods. You know, I was always a good buyer because I was able to just sort of see patterns and just kind of go with those and, you know, see patterns in the inventory and the point of sale system. And it was just all intuitive, you know? So some people can do that, I guess. I don't think of it as psychic at all. I think it is just the ability to kind of switch between detail and the larger view, going back and forth like that. Cause I don't know that everybody can do that.
Micro macrocosm.
Yeah, we'll see how this is fleshed out, I guess, as time moves along.
As time goes by, yeah. You know, maybe after she hears this, maybe after they hear this, they'll recontact me and say, hey, I've got more info. Who knows?
Yeah, let's hope we can continue this investigation with Absolutely. You. Not too many people know someone who knew a serial killer.
Yeah, so. And when you first contacted me about coming on about this, I was like immediately intrigued. I was like, "Oh yeah, we definitely got to talk about this for sure." And that episode, which by the way, for anybody that's listening, that you can go back, you can listen to that episode 362. I was definitely picking your brain a little bit about that, and then some of the magical aspects of it too were just as equally fascinating. Before we let you go, Professor Wham, is something that you're working on now? Like it's been 6 months. So anything that has been like grabbing your interest lately or special projects?
Yeah. Well, what I've been working on lately, you know, because as you know, I wrote this book, Mysterious Beauty, Living with the Paranormal in the Hudson Valley. And one of the things I mentioned in that book is a haunted gym. And I provide like a photo that the guy who runs the gym took of a face that appeared in the window at one point. And I talk about it a little bit. Well, things have continued there. And so based on some of the footage, the CCTV footage, which is very good, some of it is very good. And some of it includes both video and audio. I've been able to finally get the owner organized enough. He's a kind of scattered guy. I got him organized enough to send me chunks of his footage so that I can send them to a guy that I know who does video and audio processing for one of the major networks in New Jersey. I mean, actually a mainstream network for New Jersey, but he has this interest. He's one of the Pine Bush archivists. And I actually worked with him some on the Pine Bush chapter, Pine Bush information in the book as well. But he has started to process some of the footage, and some of it is really amazing. It's like some of the best poltergeist stuff I've ever seen and heard. I mean, cool. Seriously. I mean, there's one piece of footage, CCTV footage, of apparently what appears to be a shadow person in broad daylight, like at 1:30 in the afternoon. And the backdrop to this image appearing is extraordinary, because when the owner of the gym has all of his cameras on, he has them all keyed to his phone, so that when the motion detector goes off, his phone notifies him. So he can actually watch in real time, if he's there with his phone, whatever is being picked up. Oftentimes this happens at night and he's asleep, you see, so he doesn't see it. But because he happened to be in the gym at the time, and in fact, he was downstairs, right at the bottom of the stairs, where this was happening. It was happening up the stairs and just down a little ways. And he was working, and all of a sudden he got this ping on his phone, and he picks up the phone and he watches in real time the shadow image appear on is picked up by the camera. And you can see very clearly an image that sort of vaguely looks human. And it peers in the room and then kind of leans over, and it's there, and it's very clear. And so it's broad daylight, so there's no lighting issues, you know? So, he immediately texted me and went, "Oh my God, oh my," cause this happened like 2 months ago. He's like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And so, we sent this to this guy to process, and he said that he saw it and the hair on the back of his head stood up. He was like, "Oh my God," you know? So I told him, just process it, you know, make sure that it's not anything else, you know, and he's found some hidden audio in a couple of the videos that, you know, it by your naked ear, just your regular ear, you can't hear anything. But if you fine tune the audio, there's something definitely there, like voices, like EVP stuff, like just right underneath everything. So I'm really excited about it. It's just totally cool. And we're thinking about putting together an investigation team to go in there.
Nice. Excellent. Well, let us know how that goes. And if any of that, the evidence and stuff gets, if you all want to release that, I'd love to see or hear some of that.
Yeah. Well, what I was thinking about talking to the guy who's doing the processing about, because he has all the equipment, you know, he has all the knowledge to do this. It's like, you know, why don't we make like a tiny documentary, you know, like 20 minute documentary, just sort of giving the history of this building. And so the thing is that we don't want the building or the owner to become well known, you know,
right.
Because this is his place of business, and the building is a landmark building in the town, the hamlet that it's in, or the village that it's in here in New York. And you don't want it to become, it's got lots of businesses in it. You don't want it to become like this weird paranormal tourist thing,
yeah.
You know, where people annoy other people. And he's afraid he'd lose customers.
Right.
Because he has already lost some people occasionally when things happen and scare them. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we don't want to talk about it and scare people even more.
Even before they come. Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's one trainer who still works there, who I actually train with sometimes. And she will not be in the building by herself. I mean, she won't do stuff in there.
Oh, it's that bad. Yeah.
Stuff is, she's been goosed by invisible things.
Oh, no.
You know? So it's like, whatever's there is mischievous, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's like, I refer to them as the bunch of buttholes, you know, it's sort of, they're not dangerous or anything. But, you know, if you're not used to that, it kind of freaks you out, you know. I mean, I'll be the first to say that I've had two experiences that are myself, and one made me just walk out. I just was like, I'm out of here. This is too early for me for this, you know. So I was upstairs in the box. I know you'll want to know what it was. I was upstairs. This is when I was boxing on a regular basis, and I had to be up there by like 6:45 in the morning. And so I was up there waiting for my trainer, who was a little bit late. And they had redone the stereo up there, and they had detached all of the speakers because the owner was getting a new stereo system up there. So there were just like these naked speakers that were mm-hmm. laying there. They weren't hooked up to anything. They were just there.
Yeah.
And so I sat down. And I had just put my wraps on the box, and I sat down, and I thought, I wonder if anything's happened here lately. It was just like a passing thought through my head. And as soon as I thought that, two voices came out of the speaker. Oh, I swear shit. To God. And one was a woman's voice, kind of faint, like if it was from far away, and I didn't understand what it was saying. And the other one was a male voice, and it sounded like it said, "Oh, we're here," or something like that. And I just went, "I'm going downstairs yeah. now. I'm out. This is too early. I haven't had enough coffee. See ya." You know what I mean? And that's right in an area where they have all kinds of things that have happened. And he's taken a number of interesting pictures, CCTV footage, just right in that area. So it's like, okay, you know, I mean, I do this stuff. And when you're actually confronted with it, you know, you're just like, okay, I'm done. You know, I don't need to deal with this right now.
Right. Well, Professor Wham, I know that you've got to get going. Please tell everybody where they can find you and find your books, your other writings, and all that.
Okay. Well, I do have a website. It's Professor Wham. That's WHAM, ProfessorWham.com. And I do have a blog page there, which I haven't added to for a while, but it's there. And the books that I have available are advertised there. There's a little bit about me there. And then if people want to email me, they can email me at ProfessorWham1, ProfessorWham1@gmail.com.
All right.
That's also listed on the website.
Perfect.
We look forward to next time and hopefully getting some more updates.
All right.
Well, yeah.
Stay on the line with us. We're going to close this section out, and guys, we'll be back out to talk a little more and close out the show on Conspiranormal. Welcome back, everybody. That was a very interesting conversation with Professor Wham. We went ahead and talked a little bit more about Robert Burdella and some of the updates there, and that episode that we did with her back in April was actually really quite popular. I've had a lot of people comment on that.
I mean, some of the most fascinating true crime stuff I've ever heard, because it has that spiritual and supernatural element to it.
Yes.
And the possible ties to larger conspiracies.
Yeah.
It's really weird. Really cool.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting to pick somebody's brain that encountered and knew a serial killer.
Yeah.
And how they dealt with that person, what that person was like, and yeah, because when you know somebody day to day and you find out they're a serial killer, I'm sure that that's probably a pretty big shock to the system.
Yeah.
I can kind of only imagine what that would be like. I think that was one I did solo, but of course you edited it, so you heard it. So,
well, she did talk about his how he had some form of what would seem like spiritual practice in this, what'd she call it, the introspection room?
Yeah.
That he had above his house, I guess, and he had, of course, a satanic mass LP by Anton LaVey. Uh-huh.
Which that's not necessarily that weird, really. I mean,
right. I'm sure
there's other people that would be interested in that stuff. And there's probably a lot of people that actually probably have that are not serial killers. So when it,
like me,
I don't know how much I would put, you know, stock of weirdness on that one, but it definitely just kind of adds to the general, I guess, milieu of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I'm interested in. I mean, I'm interested in the whole serial killer stuff. It's kind of a morbid fascination with me too. But you know, like I watch a lot of documentaries about this kind of stuff, and it's not something that you really see too much in the news anymore. It seems like it was something that was really rather like the time of the 70s or 80s, even extending into the 90s. And really after kind of like Jeffrey Dahmer, that's like the biggest one that I probably remember.
And they're all the questions. I know we've talked a lot about Tom and Jenny about that. Why there doesn't seem to be as many serial killers anymore, whether it's because forensics makes it really hard to get away with this stuff. Or on the other side of things, really speculative, you know, you start getting into some of like the Dave McGowan type of stuff. And the idea is that maybe this was a part of something bigger. And, you know, there's kind of hints of that around this case. So it's pretty weird.
Like an Operation Phoenix type or Phoenix program type of thing is what McGowan was talking about in Program to Kill. Yeah, that's a possibility. I think a lot of it has to do really with the rise of the internet. I think with some of the availability of, especially, let's just say it, just porn. I think that some of these, that provides an outlet for somebody that has like rather, you know, different kind of like sexual interests, you know. And not to say that there's like serial killers don't exist. I'm sure they do. And I'd be interested to see in other societies what the prevalence of that really is, because a lot of the serial killer material is really, you know, focused on either the English speaking world, which, you know, the UK and the US, sometimes Australia and those types of places,
or Europe in general.
Yeah So I would be curious to see what that's like in like a non-Western context. I think that would be kind of interesting, but we're gonna close out the show with thought that this was an interesting thing. Of course, this is gonna be posted much later, but there was an event in Dallas today that I thought was interesting. Apparently, the latest thing in QAnon, well, it's not really the latest thing, but apparently JFK Jr., they've been expecting him to show back up any time now.
Raised from the dead.
Of course, JFK Jr. died in a plane crash.
That's what they want you to think.
That's what they want you to think. Back in 1999. So it's been a good 22 years. But today, as we're recording this on November 2nd, 2021, a lot of people gathered, a ton of people actually kind of gathered in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, because they thought that not only JFK Jr. was coming back, but apparently JFK Sr. was coming back from the dead, or he's in hiding or something. And
hidden imam.
And Jackie, yeah. So somebody pointed out that this was like the Father, Son, and the Holy Mother returning.
Yeah.
So it's got like a really big kind of like Christian kind of element to it. And I thought I'd read just a little bit from this article, just to see what, just kind of giving you an idea of just how weird this is.
Is that a Vice article, Adam?
Yeah, of course. Where else would it be? So some QAnon followers were so eager to secure their place for the return of JFK that on Monday night, hundreds of them gathered in Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was shot in 1963, waiting for the latest QAnon conspiracy theory to come true. Apparently, this comes from a YouTuber called Whiplash347 that has 250,000 followers.
Expert. Sounds like an expert.
We've got like, what, like, you know, maybe 2,000 subscribers, something like that. So apparently we got to step up our game. So apparently this comes from the whole idea that, of course, this has to do with Trump. And they say that Trump is going to be reinstated as the 18th president of the United States, because in case you didn't know, and this is kind of this combination of the sovereign citizen material with QAnon, in case you didn't know, since 1871, we have been a corporation, not a country. So Trump all is going to come and restore the country. This was supposed to actually have happened on March the 4th of this year, which was the original inauguration date before it was changed January 20th, because, of course, the United States is a corporation. And Trump was going to be actually the actual 18th president of the United States. So any president since Ulysses S. Grant has actually not been an actual real president of the United States.
Right.
And that actually includes Trump himself.
Whoa.
So wait. I guess this will actually be his first his first term as president. So this is what this article says. So this guy's name, some of the Negative 48 channel that's got 100,000 subscribers, says that Kennedy, but the bloodline of the Kennedys is directly linked to Christ. Did you know that? And told his followers that on Tuesday, JFK Sr., Jackie, and JFK Jr. will be reintroduced to the world. Then the JFK Sr. will travel around for 7 days, then will pass. That sounds really biblical. Before he dies, however, JFK Sr. will transfer power to Donald Trump, and JFK Jr. will be Trump's vice president. And another part of the conspiracy claims that JFK's return will coincide with the reversion to the Julian calendar, which means the date will change immediately back to October 20th. So somehow the Julian calendar is important here. So you can just add all this in, you know.
It's just another
right,
another piece of infinite game and minutia for people to get involved.
I'm not
in.
So sure it would actually be October 20th, because I think that if you're a student of the Russian Revolution, you know that you have to look at those dates, because like the dates in the Russian Revolution are actually the Julian calendar dates.
Oh, okay.
Which the Bolsheviks changed to in 1918, changed the Gregorian calendar.
See, the communists like the Gregorian calendar. That's
that,
why.
That must be it. That must be it. So the Julian calendar is the actual legitimate calendar. And okay. I see where it's going.
Yeah. So the communist banksters, you know, back in the day,
you're right.
Changed it along with changing the United States to a corporation.
But see, that was 100 years ago that there was a 2-week discrepancy. So I think it would be even more of a discrepancy now. So it actually wouldn't be October 20th. I think it's like more like a 3-week or 4-week.
Well, sounds like you got something to start a new YouTube channel about.
Man, I could. I could just wear a mask and just do my own YouTube channel.
So, yeah, obviously, you know, we see this video here with no motorcade coming through.
Yeah. I think there were more people at this than there were at the actual Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, it looks like it.
If you look at the footage, it looks like there were a lot of people that were there.
Well, I mean, what were they selling? Like, what was really the point of this? I mean, it's usually about some kind of commerce. I mean, why did everyone have to go there? Was it this elaborate conspiracy of a hot dog stand or something?
I don't know. I mean, it seems very messianic to me. Like, it almost seems like, oh, we're going to restore, you know, the true ruler of the country. I don't know. But I mean, you know, you add in the Kennedy assassination stuff, and I mean, really, if you want to look at it, the root of all this kind of conspiracy theory in the United States is really the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. I mean,
really, that's like the open wound that causes the rest of all of this.
Yeah.
If you really want to, you know, look at it that way. So I found that pretty interesting as well, that's a part of it.
And they never showed up, right?
No, nobody showed up.
They never do.
So yet again, another failed prophecy. But you can see how it's starting to kind of take on the form of like a religion, like a real religious type of element.
Yeah. Going on, well, here. It always has been. I mean, we've talked about that.
Yep.
You know, they're getting their messages from their hidden master, you know, there's a lot of parallels.
So we just wanted to talk. I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff where we're going to be doing here.
Feels great to be back.
Does feel
the other side of Strange Realities?
Yeah, absolutely. We recorded last week a short segment. The interview with Tobias Whalen I had recorded actually before, but it does feel good to be back and just to be doing the show again. Which we're going to be pretty much going to be winding down the year, but we've got. So great guests coming on. We got Jack Brewer coming on next. Timothy Renner is going to be back to talk about a project he's doing. I've got Jose Herrera and Ren are actually going to we're going to be doing a little roundtable with them at the end of this month. And of course, we'll end up the year with Dr. Future. I got to ask him, but I'm pretty sure he'll do it. And
he will do it.
You know, there's one thing that we're going to be doing here pretty soon. We're going to be starting to do like an episode a month that is just myself and Zerfiel. And we've got some ideas of kind of about what we're going to do.
We're wanting to really double down on the conspiracy part of Conspiranormal, but in the cool, smart way that we do.
Yeah.
And we really want to trace
JFK Jr. is coming back.
Yeah,
and we're going to restore the Julian calendar because reasons.
We really want to go back and really explore the kind of genealogy and history of a lot of conspiracy theory and going back to the primary texts that have really influenced everything. Probably starting with some of the Illuminati exposés, like Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robison.
H.M.
And from there, we'll probably go into some of the other occult-oriented conspiracism against the French Revolution, Bolsheviks, and all that. We just really want to explore this stuff and like give ourselves a reason to have to read some of this primary stuff.
Yeah.
And really get to the root of a lot of these rehashed conspiracy theories and try to see how far back a lot of them really go and get to thinking about conspiracy theories in other ways. Just give our perspectives and try to find new ways of looking at this stuff and understanding our current world and where these ideas came from.
So we're going to be kind of doing like a mini podcast within a podcast, basically. That's kind of what we're going to be doing. And we're going to be doing that every single month. So you guys are going to get one of those episodes every single month. We really want to, you know, start talking about this stuff and from a historical point of view too. So stay tuned for that. We'll probably be doing that pretty soon in the next few weeks. So stay tuned for that. And of course, that's going to be all through 2022 as well as what we plan to do. And of course, Patreon, we are going to be getting back. Actually, we're going to be doing a Patreon here in just a little bit that's going to follow this episode. And we're going to get back into that and giving everybody kind of like a Patreon, whether that's myself and Zerfiel or with the guests, either one. So you guys are going to start getting that back every single week.
Yeah.
And of course, we are looking forward to doing the monthly Strange Realities kind of meetups, speakers. We're going to be doing those every single month, and those are going to be on Zoom. We're kind of still hashing out the details on that and how we're going to do it and what night we're going to do it. So we will let you know. Of course, stay tuned and posted to this. So
you can find our Patreon at patreon.com/conspiranormal, where you can join the International Association of Conspiranormalists for only $5 a month. You can get an extra episode every week to complement the Conspiranormal weekly podcast. And for $10 and up, you get to join the Mystic Crew, which gets you a ticket into the monthly hangouts, like Adam described earlier. For $20 and up, you get a special mystical garment, and we've got some leftover Strange Realities ones too. So if you'd rather substitute the normal Conspiranormal shirt with the alien with the fez on it for one of those, we can do that. Your celestial garment. But you also get entrance into the ancient circle of Strange Realities at that $20 most elect elite level.
All right, guys, I think that's going to be it for this episode. Join us on the Patreon side in a few days, and we will be back next week with Jack Brewer on Conspiranormal.
Please consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.